Now on the Regeneration Show.
We're learning about mindful eating with Dr. Lynn Rossi.
I discovered that so many people suffer needlessly around food. And my biggest hope is that people will begin to love food as much as I do and trust it and trust their bodies.
Your itinerary is being regenerated. Please turn right, turn left, turn right. Regenerating. Please take a 180 degree turn. Please take another 180 degree turn. Going forward, wake up 15 minutes sooner. Keep up with world events. Determine your retirement spending needs. You are going in the wrong direction. Try paleo. Keto. Regenerating. Conserve your water. Lower your resting heart rate. Please turn around. You might have left your oven on. You have reached your destination. The Regeneration Show with Andrew St. Germain and Stephanie Katona.
Hello and welcome back to the Regeneration Show. I'm Stephanie Katona in Los Angeles, California.
I'm Andrew St. Germain in Toronto, Ontario.
How's it going over there in Toronto?
The fact that there's no construction happening right now, I feel much more in my zone than the last episode. Like my brain just felt like a brick last time, so I just didn't know if I was making any sense.
So you were I think. I'm like, I think. Hopefully.
That was a way of giving me reassurance and then taking it back immediately.
I was like, I think you made sense, but
you're
I'm
really
not entirely.
Good, I think.
Does your energy feel a bit scattered today? I don't feel centered.
I just did not sleep last night. I woke up three times to the sound of knocking. And it was apparently in my dreams, but it was so realistic that I thought people were at the door. So three times in the middle of the night, I got up and I checked the little peephole, checking if it was the killer or a thief or something. And I look around the hallway and there's nobody there. So after the third time, I Google.
The interpretation of someone knocking on your door in the middle of the night of a dream.
I Google, hear knocks in my sleep. And do you know what I was told at 4 a.m?
What?
That I have something called exploding head syndrome.
And what on earth is that all about?
It is an abnormal sensory perception during sleep in which a person experiences unreal noises that are loud while they're sleeping.
And is this the first time this has happened to you before?
Yeah, I think so. The causes are unknown. It is also known as episodic cranial sensory shock or snapping of the brain. So suffice to say, I did not get back to sleep after that. Because when I Googled it, I thought maybe it'd be like, it's an angel just knocking or like it is a symbol of money in your future. No, exploding head syndrome is what I was.
Oh my God. I will literally, as soon as I have a really deep dream, I will literally interpret it the next day.
It's really interesting to me, actually.
Me too. I would love to study it more.
Because dreams are so mysterious to everyone. There's so much that we don't understand about them.
And interestingly enough, like a lot of the times if we have a dream about, I don't know. I'm trying to think of something here.
What do you dream about, Stephanie?
Well, I usually have dreams about being in water in the ocean and not surfing, but swimming or being in the ocean and waves kind of crashing down on me. It's terrifying. Or I'll dream about being on a roller coaster, my teeth falling out. I know it all sounds really bad.
So you're on the roller coaster, you're at the top. And your teeth fall out on the road?
No, not at the same. No, that's a separate dream.
Oh, because that's like the worst dream ever.
That's terrifying.
Your other dream sounded like a reality. Weren't you just surfing amongst waves crashing down on you?
Like how I was.
Encarnitas? Is that what it's called?
Encinitas. Oh my God. It was beautiful. So such a contrast to LA. I'm really glad I went because I love LA here in West Hollywood, but Encinitas is a little surf town off the grid. Literally, it's like one street, that's it, with shops and big surf culture there. And I went surfing for the first time in like a couple years. And the waves
so you had been before.
I've surfed in Costa Rica like three times. So I've done it and I'm getting better because it was super wavy and I got up and I was very proud of myself. So
you should be.
It's addictive. Now I want to go back because I want to keep surfing and getting better at it. I can see why it becomes an addiction for people.
I can see because I like to ski. And for me, when you're going down the mountain on skis, that to me is such a natural high. So I assume that when you're in a wave, just right? The sensations, it must be a similar high.
But even more, like I snowboard and ski too, but it's like, imagine like there's this wave coming and you ride the wave in. It's so cool. I can't even describe the feeling. It's euphoric. Honestly.
Although I don't like cold water, and I also am not a very strong swimmer, so my feeling would be more deadly.
Wetsuit.
Oh, that actually insulates
you? It works. Yeah, insulates you, yeah. I wasn't cold.
Does it make you a stronger swimmer? Would I look funny with water wings on top of my wetsuit?
I could actually see you with those little orange little water wings on your arms.
You got to do what you got to do.
Do what you got to do.
And one thing that we're going to do in just a few minutes is welcome another guest to our conversation. Her name is Dr. Lynn Rossi. She's the president of the Center for Mindful Eating. You said, Stephanie, you want to talk about mindful eating for this episode. So I hope you don't mind. I went ahead and called the president. So in the Regeneration Show spirit, by the end of this episode, Stephanie, what messages and beliefs would you like us to unlearn about food and diet culture?
Oh man, this is a topic I am very passionate about, you know, having gone through my own personal journey and struggles with food and body image before becoming a health and wellness coach. It's such an important conversation to have because I think that everyone can relate and recognize how diet culture and just living in this world, honestly, has impacted their relationship with food and their bodies. And it's ingrained in our psyche and very complex in how it shows up for every individual. We all experience it on a different level. We've ultimately been conditioned to just not trust and listen to our bodies and our own inner wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Or just not listen to your body cues when you're full, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And this is why practicing mindful eating is so key to healing our relationship with food, because it really encourages this full presence with our eating experience.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you are someone who practices mindful eating?
So I'll be honest, I'm usually pretty on it. Like, you know, I have been, but now after I've been traveling the last couple months and basically packing up my entire life and traveling around, I notice that I do get anxious and stressed if I don't have a stable foundation and my routine set in place. So the first 2-3 weeks, it took me about 2-3 weeks to settle into, you know, the new environment. And I noticed I was a bit all over the place with my exercise routine and meditation practice. So I had to really anchor myself back in, and now I'm back on it. So it happens, but I have been really good in the last couple of weeks. How about you?
I have been not the greatest in the last couple of weeks because a certain trainer went ahead and left the country. So my routine has been interrupted. So I have to get back on that.
Do I need to fly home to come and train you?
If it's not too troublesome, I wouldn't mind.
But tell me about the mindful eat. So let's talk. Have you practiced mindful eating?
I need to be very mindful about it. It's so true, because it's my tendency, honestly, Stephanie, to maybe undereat, because food is never really at top of mind for me. I started to get this reputation about my indifference towards food. And my friends would joke like, Andrew, have you eaten yet today? Because chances are I skipped breakfast. Chances are I was working through lunch. Chances are I'd just been sort of like picking at whatever was around the office, like a banana or a bag of chips or something. Like, and then I would eat maybe on my walk home, I'd pick up a burger. Like, I just did not have a healthy food routine. This is prior to knowing you. But the irony was, Stephanie, I was gaining weight at inexplicable rates. Like, I would joke with my friends. So they would say, have you eaten yet today? And then my joke in response would be, I don't understand how you can eat so little and be this fat. Because I was like 50 pounds overweight.
Because you were destroying your metabolism and you were eating probably empty calories.
And I was drinking a lot of my calories, like lattes and macchiatos and things like that. So that's when I had to turn to coaching and professional help, because it did not make sense in my brain, because I didn't understand mindful eating or anything. Obviously, I just described a typical day, and that's not a healthy way to go through.
Yeah, but you've improved so much since we trained. So I'm really proud of you. You have.
I follow instructions. The only thing I don't do is I don't have my avocado toast on a rice cake. But you know what? If you really put a gun to my head and said, replace this English muffin with a rice cake, I'd acquiesce and I'd go, okay, fine. Rice cake.
You would. You would.
I would. I just don't like to eat alone.
That makes sense to me, though. You mean you like to have a nice meal with someone?
With somebody. And when I'm by myself, I'm just eating because I'm hungry. I wouldn't feel boredom and then replace that boredom with food. Food is not an activity for me. In fact, I find it kind of, I don't know. It's just, it, to me, it's just chewing. So having a gym structure helps me to, okay, I need to have breakfast because I need fuel for the workout, that kind of thing.
That's something that can be worked on, is like, I think what would be great for you is to experiment with different recipes, with different food recipes, and to actually bring in more joy with your cooking experience and just experimenting with new foods and, you know, really savoring the food rather than, I know you eat for fuel, but that can be something that is, you know, worked on.
When I'm with friends, that's when I indulge. That's when I'll read a menu and I'll look at the ingredients in something and, oh, that's a really interesting flavor combination. I'm going to get that for a starter and get that to share with the table and get that for dinner. Like, that's when I indulge. But when I'm just by myself, I mean, I'm better than I used to be. When I was a kid, I could have a turkey sandwich on white bread with mayo and nothing else for breakfast, dinner, lunch. I mean, name something more boring than a turkey sandwich on white with mayo, nothing else. So
I know you do eat like that, sweet potato, chicken, and broccoli every day, all day. I don't know how you do it.
I'm very boring. And maybe that you're right. Like, maybe that is its own problem. My indifference towards food. I need to find more satisfaction from it.
Well, hopefully our new guest, Lynn, will be able to provide us with some tips on that. And I'm sure she will.
Mm-hmm.
So in our last episode, Kim Eagle talked about, you know, how kids are so in tune with their bodies. They eat when they're hungry. They don't eat when they're not. Their relationship to food is not really tied to certain rules, restrictions, do's and don'ts. It's simple and straightforward. But then as adults, we become bombarded with messages around, you know, what to eat, what not to eat, glorifying weight loss. And it's no wonder that we become disconnected, feel abandoned, and stop trusting and tuning into our bodies.
And when do you think that starts? Is it when we start introducing maybe food as a reward, or when we start telling kids to finish what's on their plate, or what do you think triggers it?
I think there's so many reasons. And again, I said, it's so unique, and every individual's experience is so unique because it can come from trauma. It can come from growing up in a family, like you said, where the parents are like forcing you to eat all the food on your plate, or they use a reward system. It can come from financial issues in the family. If the food, certain foods weren't available at the time, it could be a coping mechanism. If you went through a lot of stress and trauma growing up, you use food as a coping strategy. So every experience is so unique.
Or you use food as a protest. Like, some people go on hunger strikes.
Like, or that.
Yeah.
Yep. They don't want to eat. Because that comes from a place of not deserving, not feeling worthy of eating food, of nourishing your body. So there's two extremes, right? You can feel unworthy and undeserving. So then in that case, you're not fueling your body, not nourishing your body. Or it could be the other extreme where you don't feel worthy and deserving and you overeat to cope with certain emotions. So again, such a complex conversation, and I'm super excited and can't wait for Lynn to give us some insights and really share her knowledge on this whole topic.
Same. And I know this is meaningful to you because you've mentioned that you have experience with both of those extremes of undereating and overexercising, and also overeating and not exercising, the two extremes of that.
Yeah. Before I became a fitness coach, I had a very tumultuous relationship with my body and eating, because I started getting into fitness when I was 15. Right. And then, you know, when I first started, I took it to the extreme where I started restricting myself because I wanted to look good, and I lost this weight and I started to look really good. Right. And I became addicted to looking good and slim and muscular and lean and all that. Right. And then it became a really unhealthy obsession. So I went through a period of restrictive behavior from about 16 to 20. And then I entered university, and I remember I lost so much weight, and I lost my period for 6 full months. Mm. I was working out twice a day, and I lost all this weight. And then I still remember I was working at this golf and tennis academy in the States. And I remember my mom dropped me off, and I actually called her 3 weeks later saying that she needed to come pick me up because I thought I gained 10 pounds and I need to be home. I was body dysmorphia, panicking, anxiety. It was so bad that I couldn't be there anymore. So she had to pick me up, And I fell apart. I went into a very dark, deep depression. And after that, that was the summer of first year university. And I just went into a really dark depression and I started eating and I like gained all this weight in a matter of 2 months, felt so disconnected from my body. Imagine you're going from a very lean athletic physique to actually the complete opposite in a matter of 1 year. And it's like, I was in total mind body disconnection. And that whole experience was shaped me so much. It really reinforced how strong our inner critics can be and how, if we don't take control and really observe our thoughts, we can actually cause ourselves so much suffering. Because that's what happened to me, was just these negative thoughts that kept appearing, that kept running through my head. And then it drove me into this depression.
Right. But it's interesting, when you were restricting yourself, what made you feel good was the way you looked.
Exactly.
So that was the trade-off, was maybe I'm under eating or maybe I'm over exercising, but I feel good. So that's self-sabotage in one extreme. And then the other extreme was what you did when you gained weight. But what made you feel good in the weight gain? Was it the eating?
I didn't feel good in either. I didn't feel good when I, and that was the whole thing. That's where the whole having to go inward and find,
because
like,
what's
actually
the
love myself and accept myself. Because when I was super slim, I still wasn't happy. And that's why I say to people, and that's why my whole story of like, I was like a six pack, like I could have done, you know, being in photo shoots and all this stuff, but I was still very insecure and deeply unhappy, even mm-hmm. when I was lean. And that was the whole irony of all of this, is that all that work and still being dissatisfied and unhappy. And then, so when I gained all that weight and then I was, you know, depressed, I made a vow to myself that I would embark on this journey again, you know, to come back to a place where I feel good in my body. And it really was like, I had to practice. I had to go in deeply inward and practice like meditation, self-acceptance, and doing things slow, like working out 3 days a week, not going into extremes. So it was a very difficult practice for me, but one that also helped me understand what it's like for other people that go through this whole weight fluctuation and why, and like how we can heal from that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an extreme thing. And I mean, not everyone can say they've gone through like just the extreme of, you know, being underweight and overweight in a matter of a year, but it was like hardest thing that happened to me, but also the best thing that happened to me, I think.
Well, now at least you can recognize the bad habits or the patterns when they're happening.
Exactly.
Like, oh, I just ate emotionally versus I ate
exactly
to actually fulfill hunger needs.
Yeah. This is essentially what inspired me to want to help others sculpt themselves from the inside out and cultivate a loving relationship with their bodies and themselves.
Yeah. And you've done a great job with that. And
thank you.
To dedicate your life to it. Obviously, this was a real turning point in your life. And now you're on the other side of it. And would you say you have a healthy relationship with food these days?
Oh my God, absolutely. I love, like, and it's so intuitive now, right? And that's where, you know, because all of that healing and work I had done to get to this point is, again, I tell people it's a process, but now it's super intuitive. I eat when I feel hungry. I really do enjoy food. I love food. You know, we've gone out for dinners. It's a whole experience for me.
Food can be a very beautiful experience.
Absolutely.
Very communal experience.
It's a social, exactly. And it's a social thing. It's a way of connecting. But I don't use it as a reward anymore or as a punishment, you know?
Yeah. I think that's what I want to get out of this episode. I want for us to achieve better body awareness and not be held captive by guilt or by gluttony.
Absolutely. And another, I really hope, having Lynn on this show, I hope to answer any questions that you may have around what a mindful eating experience looks like, how to work through emotional eating, dealing with triggers, and ultimately how we can find a sense of safety and trust in our bodies so that we can become more conscious and present and truly just enjoy our eating experience on a daily basis.
That's what I need to get out of it. I need to enjoy food more, because, okay, a very common question that you get from people especially if it's an icebreaker, is, okay, you're on death row, which, by the way, if I've just met somebody, I don't know why they're already talking about death row, but okay, you're about to die. What is your last meal? And I don't have an answer for that, Stephanie. I don't have like a favorite food that I want to eat before I die.
I actually had to ponder that question as well, but there is one particular food that sticks out, and it's tacos. And you don't need to say it, but tacos, like, it's got a bit of everything, crunchy texture, soft on the inside, a lot of flavors.
Are you also a fan of like oysters? Like a life?
No.
Linguine and clams?
No, I'm not. No, the oysters, no, they don't do it for me. I know people ask me all that all the time. If I like tacos, should I not like oysters too? No.
You do love Mexican food. I think most of the time that I've gone out for dinner with you, it's been to a Mexican restaurant.
I know, honestly. And so you don't have a favorite food?
It's a question that perplexes me. I honestly don't have an answer to it.
Steak.
I love steak, but it's like I don't need it. I can't imagine I'm about to die thinking, I would just kill for a ribeye right now. Like, I don't know. I don't know what it'd be. Maybe a turkey sandwich on white bread with mayonnaise for old time's sake. And
or sweet potato maybe now. Okay.
Sweet potato is not going to be my last meal. It is my 365 day a year meal. I don't need it on my last day.
Something to think about. Something you should start, you know, experimenting in the kitchen a little more.
I need to. Yeah. So maybe that's what Lynn can help me with is.
Yeah.
Is
I think she'll be able to really help on that because she wrote her book on Eat and Savor Every Bite.
Yeah. So right? Dr. Lynn Rossi, she, as you said, the author of the new book, Savor Every Bite, and the president of the Center for Mindful Eating, is here with us, and she is next up on The Regeneration Show.
You're listening to The Regeneration Show with Andrew St. Germain and Stephanie Katona. Pass it on, theregenerationshow.com.
Now we are honored to have Dr. Lynn Rossi joining us on the show. Lynn is a health psychologist, researcher, and teacher best known for her mindful eating program, Eat for Life. Her new book, Savor Every Bite, offers exercises that teach you how to live and eat mindfully, move your body in ways that feel delicious and live with greater ease and joy. She joins us from Columbia, Missouri. Lynn, welcome to the Regeneration Show.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for answering the invitation. I want to get into that later, that feeling of deliciousness, what delicious feels like. But first, yes. I want to invite you to give a little background about yourself and what inspired you to start your research and devote your life's work to this.
Well, I really started out in mindfulness itself and became aware of Jon Kabat-Zinn's work and his work with the mindfulness-based stress reduction program when I was in my doctorate program. And I just really benefited in my own personal life with the mindfulness practice. And then I started studying a lot of Buddhism and got a lot of benefit from that and did a lot of meditation retreats. And it really changed my life. I mean, it really changed the way I look at the world, the way I look at it myself, the way I related to my emotions, the way I related to my thoughts. And I was just hooked, you know, that's all I wanted to do. And so I actually have made an entire career out of teaching mindfulness, first at the University of Missouri, which was kind of unheard of at the time. And then when I was there, my director of the wellness program asked me if I would teach a class on eating, on, you know, a class that would help people have a better relationship with food and their bodies. And I knew it would have to include a strong mindfulness component. So I developed a program and then did some research on it. And over the years, I've tweaked it here and there, added this and that. And so then I wrote a book about it. And then just recently wrote another book looking at some of the just small little practices that we can do to bring more joy into our life, to bring more happiness. And also how to deal with our emotions, how to deal with our thoughts, because these are the two biggest problems that we have is how do you deal with your emotions and how do you deal with your thoughts? And of course, they're related. And they also then end up creating sensations in our bodies that we have to deal with as well. So I just loved it because I love to help people stop suffering. And that's really the key for me. And I discovered that so many people suffer needlessly around food. And I love, love, love food, right? And my biggest hope is that people will begin to love food as much as I do and trust it and trust their bodies. Because I know trusting your body is a big theme for you guys. And people don't trust their bodies. And so how do we get people back to trusting themselves and their own inner wisdom instead of some new diet that's coming down the road that offers them some, you know, golden pot at the end of the rainbow, you know, which doesn't exist. And then it all basically, I've been thinking about this a lot, obviously, but it all starts and stems from this overwhelming societal feeling that we're not enough.
Yep.
Right.
Like, yeah. It's and, that shame, right?
Yeah. Shame and guilt and, just really feeling like I'm not living up to what I should be. I'm not looking the way I should, because we buy into all these diet culture messages and the messages from Hollywood, the messages from, you know, everywhere we're being bombarded with, buy this product, because until you do, you won't be enough.
I did want to ask, the word diet, is it a dirty word? Do you like that word? What's your relationship with the word diet?
It's not a good word or a bad word. It's just a word, right? So our tendency is to place some kind of label on it. So are you talking about a calorie restricted diet? Are you talking about a diet of, you know, certain kinds of foods that you've decided to eat? I mean, what's the definition of diet? Unfortunately, usually it means in this culture that I'm restricting myself from something. And so when we restrict, we're going to suffer, because at some point we're going to binge, right? It's the restrict binge cycle. You can't tell yourself, no, you can't have that. No, you can't have that, without there being later on a reaction to that and then overdoing it, right? So we give up. In the mindful eating classes, we really let go of restriction, which happens in a diet, because you want to come naturally to what food feels good for your body. And if you have restrictions, you're not going to learn that, right? So we open up the doors and say, try it, you know, see what happens, because your body is really the experiment. You're the scientist, you know, just notice and let yourself be guided by what you noticed. And that's really the kind, compassionate way of eating.
And it really does, honestly, even as a health and fitness coach, it really takes time to learn and see what works for your body. Everyone is so unique. And I know for me, I mean, I've experimented with many different ways of eating, and it's a constant thing. You just constantly refine it, and then you tune in and ask yourself, like, how does this, you know, food sit in my body? How do I feel after I eat it? You're just constantly refining it all the time. You know, it's not just one size or one fits all approach, right?
Right. Exactly. Which is why it's so hard to, you know, why it's not that helpful to listen to somebody else telling you what you should or shouldn't eat. It's your body. It has the wisdom. And so what you want to learn is how to tap into it.
It's interesting you say, like, the talking about the diet cultures, we are conditioned to basically always feel like we need to be on a diet. Like, it's almost like if you're not on the next diet, you're obviously not up to par, or something's wrong with you if you're not trying to look better or lose weight or
the next problem is that the mindset, the belief system that says I need to be getting better is going to follow you no matter where you go. The mindset, I'm not enough right now, which is why I have to be on the diet, is still going to be there even if you would lose weight. Like, it doesn't matter how much weight you lose. It doesn't matter how you look. It doesn't matter how many wrinkles you get rid of, which is pretty hard to do, by the way. as an aging woman, I can say that. And so, it's like, it's never going to work. It's like, seek, but do not find. That's the whole message of the consumer culture. It's like, seek, but do not find, because you're not going to find it out there. You're going to find it inside. And there's nothing more beautiful than a woman who has gone from really despising her body and judging it every day from the minute that she wakes up in the morning to moving to this place of, kindness and compassion and trust and love and care for her body just the way it is. And from there, you want to treat your body well. And so really what we're looking for is, how can I be healthy enough to live the life I want to live? Mm-hmm. I want to be there for my children, my grandchildren, my partners, mm-hmm. my community, whatever. I want to be able to engage in life, and mm-hmm. we want to be healthy enough to do that. That's bliss right there. That's living fully. And it doesn't matter what size you're in. You know, it doesn't matter your weight. The weight on a number on a scale is not going to determine that. So yeah.
And it's this whole reprogramming is really, we need to reprogram ourselves into this, like the way that we view and perceive exercise and food is like, we should be exercising to feel stronger, to feel better, to feel healthier, rather than to punish ourselves, to lose weight, to be able to afford that piece of cake. Right.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I just taught a class on one of the weeks of my 10-week class is moving your body in ways that feel delicious, right? Yeah. So I ask people to just drop down inside, like right now, just drop down inside, take a deep breath, let it out with a sigh, and just notice, scan your body. Have you even felt your body today? Have you done anything but be consumed with your body from the neck up in your thoughts? Drop down below the neck and notice, are my shoulders a little tight? Is my neck sore? Is my back a little tight? What do I need to do? Like right now, I'm just rolling my shoulders, right? Because it feels really delicious to do that. And I'm loosening up. And I love to just reach my arms over the head and take a deep breath and take a little stretch. I'm also a yoga teacher, so that gives you any clue. But everybody can do yoga, right? If you can breathe, you can do yoga. Right? Because yoga is about body and breath and bringing our attention to the present with our body and our breath, so that we extract the attention away from the thinking mind, which is basically usually telling us something not so good, mm-hmm. into direct physical sensations in the body, and then responding to those physical sensations, because the body tells you when to get a drink of water, when to eat, when to stop eating, what felt good to eat, how much do you want to eat, when do you want to move, when do you want to connect, what emotions are in the room, what's the mm-hmm. energy around you. I mean, it tells you so many things. And if we're not paying attention, we're missing out on great wisdom.
I teased it at the beginning, but I want to know how you would define the feeling of deliciousness. What does delicious feel like?
It feels like I'm bringing ease into my body, right? I'm cultivating ease through my movement. It's loosening me up. It's letting me be relaxed, so that I can come into a place of stillness and peace.
And doing it yourself without the help of substances.
Yes. Yes.
And that's a delicious way to live.
It is.
I love this, because this actually, what you're just saying, ties into my first question that I have for you. Because even as a fitness and health coach, being someone who's very cerebral and thinking I'm connected to my body and realizing that I wasn't so connected to my body. So why is it that a lot of us don't feel safe in our bodies to drop into our bodies? Is it just a lack of self-trust from messages that we've gotten? Is it trauma related? Sometimes a combination of both?
Yes.
Yes to all the above.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's so many things. That's why I love teaching mindful eating to people, because it's not just about eating, really. It's about your whole body. It's about your whole life. It's about everything. Mm-hmm. And it's complex, right? It's complex and complicated. You know, we're all different. We're all unique. But I think the main thing is that we haven't been taught to be in our bodies in a safe way, right? Our bodies have been objects, right? Particularly for women, I think. Mm-hmm. The body is objectified, right? Mm. And so that's scary. If you're a girl and your body's being objectified all the time, it's like that gives you a different relationship to it that becomes unhealthy, really. And then there can be trauma, you know, around the body as well. There's lots of reasons to think that there's a lot of trauma involved in our bodies. And it doesn't just mean sexual trauma. It's the trauma from living in this world, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of trauma. It's traumatic to live in, particularly our world today, right? And so when we practice mindfulness, we practice dropping down in the body, right? And even there's trauma sensitive mindfulness. So if you have trauma, be sure before you start practicing mindfulness to find somebody that's trauma sensitive in their work, because it can be very difficult if you've had trauma to drop down into your body because your body doesn't feel safe. So I just want to say that. But most of us can learn to become more embodied by simply noticing, by scanning the body, by really bringing our attention to the sensations in the body and the breath. And then when the mind wanders away to thoughts, you simply notice and bring your attention back. That's the entire yoga practice right there, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Yoga really traditionally means it's the cessation of the fluctuation of the mind. Mm-hmm. Really has nothing to do with the body, really. It's about we bring attention to the body and the breath so that we're not paying attention to the mind, which, by the way, we have 60 to 80,000 thoughts a day, and most of them are negative, repetitive, and useless, right? Okay, so if you're listening to the mind, good luck, you know, because it's just not telling you anything all that good. That's why we bring ourselves into stillness, into silence through the body and the breath. And when we can start to connect to that, yes, you are going to discover everything you've been avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
And warning light, right? Caution. When you start practicing mindfulness, you will come face to face with all the things you've been avoiding. But the good news is you'll be given the skill to be with it in a kind, compassionate, loving, caring way and discover you didn't need to run away to begin with.
Yeah.
Weren't taught how to be with it.
Yeah. We're always taught to use the easy buttons and distract ourselves. Right. And so like it's scary for us, and it's deeply uncomfortable to sit with emotions that are, you know, like anger, shame, fear. And even though they pass just like all the other emotions, it's just that, like you said, we're not taught, we don't have the skills to manage them or to allow them to kind of flow through us.
It's more deeply uncomfortable to resist them over and over again. So mm-hmm. what most people don't know is that all of that resistance, all of that struggle that you're, you know, putting, all that energy you're putting towards resisting the difficult, resisting the emotion, resisting how that feels, is actually prolonging the emotion itself. And so you're actually keeping it strong. What you resist persists. So yeah. When we learn how to just open up and go, okay, let me just feel this. Let me take a breath. Let me notice what's happening inside my body. Let me notice and let me name what emotion am I having. This is really important. Mm-hmm. If we can name the emotion that we're having, which, by the way, most people don't know how to do very well. Mm-hmm. And if you can name the emotion, it's called affect labeling, you're actually increasing activity in the prefrontal cortex of your brain, which is your decision-making and problem-solving areas and emotional regulation. And you're decreasing activity in the amygdala of the brain, which has to do with threat detection, right? So if you're always on threat detection, everything's a threat, right? So we want to dampen that down and increase our capacity to regulate. And simply by naming accurately the emotion you're having, that already begins to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So we stop and we name it, we label it, anger or sadness or loneliness, whatever it is. And then you'll notice this little bit of relief that sets in automatically. And then you kind of investigate a little bit further. What am I telling myself, right? Because usually it's what we're telling ourselves about things that make things worse. And what stories am I believing? And what's a different way of looking at this? Or what is this trying to teach me? Because I do think emotions are there to teach us something a lot of the time.
For sure.
And yeah. And then you keep going, but you don't identify with the feeling as who you are. It's right. Just yeah. Something that's passing through. It's not who you are. I am not lonely. There's loneliness present. It's here right now. I can feel it. I can hold it. I can be compassionate to myself. I can nurture myself with kindness and just acknowledge it like you would a good friend. And then pretty soon it has a chance to move through. You've opened to it. You've given it space. Mindfulness gives things space in which to move through your awareness. And so I like to say emotions are mentionable, they're manageable, and they're natural.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the root cause of emotional eating and addiction is directly linked to these suppressed and unprocessed emotions generally, right?
And yeah, or just being unconscious. You know, we have these unconscious patterns of, oh, if I'm stressed, let me reach for some food because it gives you comfort. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with comfort, but if it becomes too often and too habitual and you don't have other skills like mindfulness, then you're going to have a worse problem than you started out with, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to have the emotion and you're going to have eaten more than the body really wants and you're going to feel a little sick and, you know, on and on. Then you're going to feel more guilt and shame and then it's this big cycle, right? And so while a little bit of emotional eating is all right, that's not what we want our go-to to be, right? Mm-hmm. We want our go-to to be something that we can do without any substance or anything outside of us, because it's there. The skill is there and we can utilize it.
There was one exercise that I found really helpful for me on my whole journey when I was working through a lot of this. And I, you know, I just called it the 5-minute check-in, like taking that 5 minutes a day or whenever you feel that trigger coming on of going towards, you know, food, is just to stop and ask yourself, like, what, like you were saying, what am I feeling and what do I need right now? What do I actually need to support myself? Right.
Yeah.
People just trying to busy themselves, like to distract themselves from.
Yeah. Like how many times do you pick up your phone and look at Facebook? You know, I mean, or what can I buy now? You know, let's see, some online shopping might do, you know, it can be anything. It can be food, Facebook, you know, any kind of social media, whatever, drinking.
Right. But if the addiction is social media, if the addiction's gambling, if it's drinking, if it's smoking, you just avoid the casino, you avoid cigarettes, but food is, it's impossible to avoid. We need food.
We do need food. Yes.
That's why it's so complicated, the relationship with food, because it's like with alcohol or cigarettes, we can live without it, but we need to eat. So that's why I find it more complicated and complex.
It is very complicated and complex. And thank goodness we need food, because we have the opportunity to have this pleasurable experience to nourish our bodies and to have food that tastes really good every day, right? And so we shift our attention away from like, how can it fix me to feel better, to how can it nourish me and how can I really enjoy it? What foods would taste good? Let's explore the world of food together, right? And I like to do that. I mean, that's more later on in the end of, it's a 10-week class, so we cover a lot of material. But by the time we're over, we're looking at, you know, our relationship to food, not just as it impacts us personally, but our relationship to food and how it affects the community, the environment, all kinds of things. Food is connected. Food is a spiritual act, right? It's a sacred act. And so I try to get people to see it not as just something to, you know, pass the time or to do while you're watching TV, but to really honor it and see it as this act of nourishing ourselves and coming into communication with the rest of the world through the food that we eat. It's really this amazing thing.
Yeah. And what are some, so say someone is trying to get to that place where they're trying to enjoy food and they're trying to restore their relationship, but they're struggling with this emotional eating and messages of diet culture. And what are some practical, like steps that they can take in order to kind of work through that to heal this relationship?
Well, I really do think having a regular mindfulness practice is essential. Mm-hmm. And so there's lots of ways of learning how to practice mindfulness. And when I say practicing mindfulness, there's informal ways of practicing mindfulness, but I do think that a formal either sitting meditation practice or mindful yoga practice is essential to learning how to get back in touch with your body. Mm-hmm. And so I just think that that's number one. I don't know how people do it without it. I know maybe that there are some people that do, but I would think it'd be very complicated. We have to become conscious, and mindfulness helps us to become conscious, helps us to develop the skills that we need to be aware. It raises our awareness of the emotions, awareness of the thoughts, awareness of our abilities to be present for those and to make different choices, because mm-hmm. mindfulness gives us choice that we don't have otherwise. You know, it's not about willpower. It's not, I mean, I just was listening to somebody talk about this today, and I'm like, it's not about willpower. It's about awareness. It's about presence. And so if you can do and learn a skill that can raise your awareness and raise your compassion and kindness through awareness, then you're going to be on your way to understanding how to deal with the thoughts, the automatic thoughts that come in your head, and the automatic patterns of reaching for food. And it doesn't happen overnight. It's going to be, you know, a process. It's going to be a journey that, and finding a teacher. I mean, I really do think when people are starting to practice mindfulness, it's really hard to just listen to a tape or read a book. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have people tell me all the time, it's like, I've read everything. I've read it all. And it just doesn't work until you really get in a position where you're being taught and getting your questions answered and guiding you through the process. So I think it's just really important to, you know, and they're available, you know, teachings and teachers are available.
Coaching does one. I'm all about coaching. Like, I think, you know, when it comes to starting a fitness regimen, nutrition regimen, going to therapy, like having that structure and accountability and someone guiding you throughout it is so much better.
Yes, absolutely.
Impactful, you know?
Yeah. And you don't have to do it alone.
Exactly. And so how can this mindful intuitive eating approach help heal and restore our relationship with food and our bodies overall?
Well, so the research shows that actually when you practice mindfulness, mm-hmm. Mindfulness is really the key to intuitive eating, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't really be an intuitive eater unless you know or practice mindfulness mm-hmm. or are good at mindfulness, because you need the awareness, right? Awareness is key. And then intuitive eating is basically eating based mainly on physical hunger cues. Right. Mm-hmm. So we know that from my research anyway, that when mindfulness increased, intuitive eating increased, and the mindfulness was the key moderator. And so intuitive eating means eating mainly based on physical hunger cues, as opposed to eating based on emotional cues mm-hmm. or cues from the environment. Right. Mm-hmm. People have food everywhere. I mean, food is ubiquitous. And so I could reach my arm out and probably reach some food right now, you know, because it's just everywhere. And so learning to be awake enough so that your hand doesn't automatically reach for the food and put it in your mouth, right? And mindfulness also helps you to increase body appreciation and body love, body kindness, whatever you want to call it. And when we know that when we appreciate our bodies and when we treat our bodies, when we love our bodies, we treat them better.
Yeah.
Right. So this self-love, this learning how to embrace ourselves, not for the way we look, but just for the fact that we're here, this body that we live in is this amazing instrument. I love to teach people about body gratitude because there's so many things to be grateful for. I can taste, I can touch, I can smell, my heart beats, my lungs breathe. I mean, I could go on and on.
I can exercise.
Yes. And so it can do delicious movement. Mm-hmm. And so it's also just shown that we reduce the self-criticism that we have about our bodies and so many things related to having a better relationship to our food and our bodies happens through mindfulness and mindful practice.
So step number one, develop a mindful practice, meditative practice, become more aware of your body, your emotional emotions, whatever's happening in the body. And then that will in turn help restore that relationship and make better choices.
And it's not just about being present. I want to really stress this. It's about being present without judgment and with kindness and compassion. Key to the whole thing.
Right.
Well, this is all new. Well, it's not news to me. It's like you said, it's intuitive. It's human nature. But I guess if you're mindful about why am I eating? Am I eating because I'm bored? And if you're very present in the actual act of eating, it makes sense to me that you will use it less and less of a crutch. Yes. Like instead of reaching for something delicious, you will do something to make yourself feel delicious instead.
Exactly. I love that.
And so you have these online courses, right?
I do. So I have a Eat for Life class, which is a 10-week class, and it's taught over Zoom to people around the world. I teach it to professionals and the public together, because I think we're all dealing with issues that we can work on. I still work on things, right?
Yeah, even the professionals.
It's not a static process. We can all learn more. But you can go to my website, lynnrossi.com, and I have information about my classes, my yoga classes, my Eat for Life classes, and my blog, which gives you all kinds of information. You can, you know, also my meditations. I have tons of meditations, free meditations on my website, including meditations on difficult emotions, meditations on eating, you name it, and yoga. So there you go. It's all in one package.
This can benefit a lot of people.
Yeah. And yeah, we'll link to that on our website, theregenerationshow.com. And I would say Lynn Rossi is a great coach on how to do that. And if you pick up a copy of Savor Every Bite, one of the first pages, I highlighted a quote because you know it deep down, but it's good to have someone tell you that if you feel urgency to fix the way you eat, fix your body or fix your life, the truth is there is nothing to fix. And yes. I think that's on the first page. And isn't that nice?
I love that.
Gave me goosebumps.
Yeah,
they're your words, Lynn. Yeah. You gave yourself goosebumps.
Wow. Thank you so much for joining us. That was actually very, very insightful and informative.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun. I really am glad that you asked me to come.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Love Get chatting posted. With you. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Good luck, you guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So you're listening to The Regeneration Show. I'm Andrew St. Germain.
And I'm Stephanie Katona.
And we have been joined by Dr. Lynn Rossi from Columbia, Missouri. She is a health psychologist, researcher, and teacher, best known for her mindful eating program, Eat for Life, and her new book, Savor Every Bite.
Her laugh is so funny.
She's cute.
She's like, I know, she's adorable. She's like, I love it.
I'm like, that was a good Lynn impression.
Wasn't it? That's exactly how she laughs.
That's so funny. Like, if anyone ever asks you if you do any impressions, you can be like, yeah, I do a great Lynn Rossi impression.
I'm pretty good at impersonating people's voices and stuff, but that's exactly how she sounds.
All right. So, Stephanie, we have come to the end of our mindful eating show. And now, besides an exciting new Lynn Rossi impression, what would you say you have learned or unlearned?
So, today, I'm going to say that I've learned that mindfulness is the key ingredient to developing intuitive eating. They aren't separate. We first have to become aware, present, and conscious. And from there, we can make choices from an intuitive place.
Yeah. And giving our body what it needs and only what it needs.
Exactly. And you have to become mindful and present first. And then that whole intuitive we develop that intuitive inner knowing of what we need after that.
Yeah. Treating our body well. That's kind of what I would say my takeaway is along the line of mindfulness. What I unlearned was to identify your feelings, but don't identify as the feeling. So I'm feeling jealous. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling sad, but I am not a sad, jealous, angry person. Like these moments are fleeting.
Totally.
That
is... I think we took a lot. I mean, we there was a lot of insights and a lot of new information.
Yeah, there's a lot. And we're just getting started. So join us next time on The Regeneration Show. Cover art for The Regeneration Show is by Antonella Giordano. Photography by Alexandria Yar. Featuring narration by Andrea Roos. Thank you again, Lynn.
Join Andrew and Stephanie for the next Regeneration Show and pass it on. TheRegenerationShow.com.